Oh man, I'm too nervous to lead us into this one. This is a big one for
oh
me.
my God.
Don't be scared, John. This is what you've been waiting for.
I know,
all
seriously.
These years.
I think this might be the reason I signed up for the podcast in the first place. It was like, in the back of my mind, maybe we could talk to Andy Stanton.
If I send him a really dodgy stalker letter type thing, maybe he'll come on the show. I mean, what kind of ridiculous idea was that that worked?
It actually worked.
These last 30 episodes have just been a cunning ruse to get to this point.
Exactly. Yep. And, we should...
I feel like our entire relationship has been a bit of a lie, John, to be honest.
Just used us.
Genuinely
some kind of stepping stone.
That's all
these
I wanted to do.
Last 20 years.
So this is probably the point, guys, where I should tell you that I'm stepping down from doing the podcast. And
I'm just going to go and live outside Andy Stanton's house in a bin, just in case he waves to me.
Yeah, so, I don't think we need a lot of introduction, really.
There once were three chaps on a podcast, and many folks thought it would not last. They couldn't be more wrong, because they're on episode 31. And they're still having a bit of a blast.
In fact, before we get to Andy, we need to ask the question. Let's do the question. Tommy, let's start with you this week, because we know what Betty's going to say.
I've written loads, Betty. I'm Betty, and I've written lots of words. Oh, they're actually quite good. As it turns out. I'm a brilliant novel writer.
Get bitter.
Well, that's Dave's bit done anyway. It's not going stupidly well, but I have been dipping in and doing 1,000 words here and there.
That's good.
It's in normal times, if it wasn't NaNoWriMo month, it'd be like, whoa, this is cool. But the kind of that big number over your head. But I think I'm probably at the point after not getting down to it in the first week and then been really busy with. Everyone is, isn't that? That's literally the point of it. But it's not been great timing in terms of that. But nevertheless, like last night, I did like 1,000 words just when normally I would have just gone to bed.
That's good. Tom,
it's kind of working.
It is, and I think what I've learned as well is that I don't really want to write a novel.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, there we go.
That's good.
I just don't think I've got the attention to drag the story through. Mm.
So what are you thinking? What would be your ideal medium?
I think maybe I need to get, you know, like my silly little sales book that kind of got to the end. I think that's probably something in that ilk is where I'm at, really. Well, that freedom just to kind of freestyle and, let it come out and kind of try the humour side. I think I just get a bit bored with the story thing because I know what's going to happen.
Right.
There is that element to it, isn't there? That you kind of, like, you know where you're just trying to get to, but it's going to be ages until you get there.
And you've got to put all these bits in place in between time. Yeah. And I wonder if that's why I've shied away from the planning thing. All these years. Because then once you've done that, it's like, well, the magic's gone. Mm. It just becomes a task, doesn't it? It's just a thing. So in some ways good, in some ways bad, but in other ways also good.
Well, it's the bit like I quite fancy the idea of going to Australia, but I'm never going to go because I can't be asked with the journey. Like, I want to be there, but I don't want to go there.
You seem to be doing quite well, though, with your journey.
To Australia?
Well, no, you're not doing so well with that.
Got out of Bristol, yeah.
Not, yeah.
No, with the book thing,
I mean, you have just polished one off and started another one and getting on quite well with it.
Yeah. Although I reached a bit of a tricky bit, halfway point.
But that's what everyone's always said, isn't it?
And I think what it is, or certainly for me, is that like the first half, the opening of it, is a lot of fun because it's like opening a menu and you get all these options in front of you and you can follow all these threads and set a load of things up. And then there comes a point where you realise, right, I've got to start pulling all these threads together now. It's like the expansion is over. I need to start pulling this together to a point and make a decision about what's actually going to happen.
It's like some kind of massively sort of like big philosophical question, isn't it, about freedom of choice and
alternate realities hanging out before you and then you shut them down.
But then at the middle of the story, all of them, they vanish and you've got that predetermined path you've got to follow really to get to the end. But I mean, there's different ways of getting there, isn't there?
So it's, you know,
that's the joy from the reader. That's for the reader's joy as well, isn't it?
Not... So you've opened a book. But what I have done, I've finally decided who the killer is, which I think is going to actually be quite useful when it comes to finishing the book.
To revealing something at the end,
otherwise it would just sort of end.
And we're back to Dave's primary school, and it was all a dream.
And actually, nobody was dead.
Nobody was dead.
Fine.
Everyone was happy, and it was all
so
good.
Yeah. So I had a bit of a wobble, but then I think I've overcome that wobble, and I'm on the downward slope to failure again now.
Lovely. Lovely.
Very good.
John, any update from you? No, great. Right, well, moving on. So we managed to get hold of Andy Stanton through fair means and foul, yep. I think it's fair to say. We should repost that letter on our Twitter for people to look at.
We should definitely put it, we'll stick it in the blog. How about that?
Yeah.
The blog.
Yeah. Well, at least two of us could be bothered to turn up for the interview anyway.
Poor Birdie. Poor Birdie.
Oh, yeah, poor Birdie.
He was quite busy, wasn't he?
Was he, though?
Yeah, well, you know, I couldn't help it. It was, I had commitments that I couldn't.
We're going to do this podcast together, Dave. I think probably being honest with each other is really.
I don't know what you mean, Tom. I think it was perfectly innocent. I just had childcare issues.
Dave, I recorded the phone call, mate.
What phone call?
Hello? Hi, mate. It's just me.
Oh, do you know what? I was just going to call you.
Oh, right. What about?
About John and his...
Author crush, yeah.
Yeah. God, he's got it bad, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. Just a bit,
Full on?
Uh-huh.
Embarrassing?
Creepy.
Stalkerish?
Yeah. I mean, kind of sweet, though, isn't it?
Yeah, in the same way a dog humping a cushion is sweet.
Yeah. Anyway, I was going to say, so I might give the interview a miss and then...
Right, yeah, because I was going to say that, too.
Oh. We can't both not do it, can we?
Well, I don't want to be there while John's getting all sexy, weird stuff.
Yeah, neither do I. Toss a coin for it?
All right.
Heads or tails?
Heads.
Okay, here we go. Ah, bollocks.
What kind of coin have you got with bollocks on? It's normally heads or tails. Hang on, is that the new 50p?
No, I mean bollocks. It's heads. You've won.
Ha! Unlucky, Tom. You're it.
Yeah, brilliant. Looking forward to playing Chaperone and Gooseberry all rolled into one.
Yeah, I'll probably just make up some excuse like I've got childcare issues or some babysitters falling through. He's daft enough to fall for that, ain't he?
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, he is.
Anyway, good luck. Loser!
Yeah, thanks a lot, mate.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, see you then.
See ya.
Bye.
That's an invasion of privacy.
So that's how it went down. Yeah.
We can only take so much fawning, I think. But I think you behave yourself pretty well in the interview, and it is a great interview.
I think I did all right considering my deep love for Andy.
Well, let's hear it then, shall we? I haven't heard this yet, so let's have a listen.
Shabba me timbers, we are delighted and honoured, and other sycophantic words. To introduce onto the podcast the one and only Andy Stanton. Hi, Andy.
Hey, hello.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you for
having
me.
You're very welcome. We're very grateful. I feel like I don't need to say that you're a children's book author because I sort of just assume that everyone's as big a fan as I am, but just
to hear it. Yeah, it reminds me what I'm supposed to be doing for a livelihood.
Well, on the off chance that you're not entirely sure and that people don't know, Andy Stanton is probably most famous for being the writer of the Mr. Gum series of children's books. And if you haven't read them, then shame on you.
Yeah, really?
Yeah,
who do you think
seriously. So Andy, by way of a little warm-up, could you just describe to us where you are right now and maybe what position you've assumed for the duration of this chat, just so we can visualise in your natural habitat?
Well, I'm in the normal place and I've got the normal position, which in my case means that I'm in my flat in North London.
Very nice.
Which, in as far as anything can be normal, that's my normality. And I'm sitting on a chair, guys. You'll be astounded to hear.
Oh, interesting.
if you'd like a little more detail, it's a sort of 70s... kind of, I think probably late 70s, early 80s, sort of roundy kind of space chair. Ooh. Well, it's not a space chair, but you know, it makes you feel like you're sitting in a spaceship because it's kind of like half a circle you're sitting on, and it's got a hydraulic stem which doesn't work properly. And I bought it for about £70 on the Holloway Road from a secondhand furniture shop because it looked really great. And then about a week after I bought it, the sort of pleather started flaking off it, so it's not in disrepair. So I'm really appearing on this podcast mostly to see if there are any restorers, furniture restorers out there who can do their refurbishment of a chair like this, because I've asked around, guys, and you phone up a guy and he'll say, oh, I don't do that modern stuff. That's modern to them. They're 70s, looking at doing things from like 1680 or something, and they won't do it. And or there's one guy on Upper Street in Islington, and he said, yeah, I can do that. It will cost you, but the fabric will cost you a few hundred quid, and then I'll do it for £550. And I thought, no. I'm not doing that well.
That's the trouble. Ask a layperson, and they will invariably tell you through no knowledge whatsoever that don't bother, mate. It's more expensive to get it reupholstered than it is just to buy a new one.
Well, they're right in this
case. Well, it turns out they are, isn't it?
Yeah, so it just goes to show that if you want something done properly, don't do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Andy, tell us a story. Tell us the story. Let's get back to Mr. Gom. Tell us a story.
Oh, right. Yeah.
How Mr. Gum.
And another thing, right, for 70 quid, though, I'm not upset. Sorry, it's a nice chair.
Of course, as a big bargain hunt fan, the question is, when you went into that shop, did they immediately knock off, like, 80% of the ticket price just because you went, what's your best price? Which seems to be always the case.
Oh, I think I do say what's your best price in a lot of places, and I like... Great, I'm glad we're talking about this. It's very, it seems to be what I want to talk about. I like to say, oh, is that the best you can do in a nice way? And then, you know, often they'll say, well, and then I'll go, And then, do you like Curb Your Enthusiasm, guys?
Yeah.
Because I get into, I think the way to barter is to get into a kind of Larry David. Not angry, irate, properly irritated at Larry David. Not at all. The opposite. The kind of stand back, rock on your heels, hand on chin and go, okay. So, all right, that's interesting. So, yeah, I like it. I don't know if I love it. And you get into that. And they sort of go, well, and you go, well. And sometimes, sometimes you get money off. I think it's important to try and rook small businesses for as much as you can.
Yeah,
no, definitely. I'll tell you what I actually think. I actually think that people like bartering. And if both parties in a barter are happy, it's a very enjoyable thing. It actually gives the salesperson more agency than you get in today's modern world. If you work at a supermarket, you can't barter with the customers. You have no agency. People who sell stuff actually enjoy, I would say, by and large, having a little game of chess with you. And if you don't want it, you don't buy it.
I mean, it's almost rude not to in some countries, isn't it? You know, you've got to go through the process.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, it is a big part of the culture. So this is brilliant. So it's been a lot of fun, guys. I'm glad we got
I hate bartering.
Do you?
I really hate it. Oh. Yeah. I just think, just put the price on the ticket and I'll just, look, if we're happy with that, that's what will happen.
I've had some good experiences with bartering. I enjoy the game.
Yeah, no.
All right.
We're just going to have to disagree on it, I think.
We've split the room. This is terrible.
Fundamentally opposed to bartering in any form. Find it abhorrent. It really is. It's offensive.
Well, okay. Cheapers. I wasn't expecting this awkwardness.
But I would be willing to move my position if we had a to and fro and talked about it, obviously.
Oh, you would, huh?
Yeah, I might. Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe a little bit. Maybe a little.
How would you, like, maybe 10%?
Yeah, well, my favorite. Probably stretch to a 15-20% move, given
this
the
is what's known as meta comedy, kids.
It's like gone full loop. It's gone so full loop that it's not really funny anymore.
It's so funny. It's not funny.
It's so funny. It stopped being funny. What I was going to say before, Andy, was I should have said this at the start. I should have probably spoken to you separately, to be honest. But you probably gathered from John's weird stalking letter in order to invite you on the show that he is like a embarrassingly large superfan.
Yeah, I did reading between the lines. And also not just between the lines, reading the lines themselves, I actually managed to
yeah.
pick it up. So
there might be moments in the next...
I didn't mean to scare you, Andy. I hope I didn't scare you.
When I saw this
point.
Letter that you, I think you, what, scanned it or photographed it and put it up on Twitter and sort of copied my name in so that it would be bound to pass my face. I did think, these guys look like a couple of weirdos. But then I also thought, yeah, but I'm quite cantankerous. Maybe it will all look like more fun tomorrow. So I slept on it. And when I looked at it the next day, I thought, you know what? They still look like weirdos. I'll sleep on it one more day. And then the next day I thought, they look like weirdos, but nice weirdos. And I'm very flattered. So thank you. I think it's a lovely thing to be asked to be on your show. Especially enjoy the Failing Writers podcast. You've spoken to a lot of writers, am I correct?
Yeah.
We have.
I would imagine that quite a few of them have said, I feel like a failing writer sometimes, even though I do that for a living.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unanimously,
that's exactly
yeah.
it. Yeah.
There you go. That's what most of...
We're all failing writers, but just on different levels.
That's exactly right. I liked the idea. I enjoyed the flattery. Thank you, guys. You're very funny lads. Well done. And I really like the idea of talking about the vicissitudes and sometimes joys of writing. So here I am. But it turns out that what I really want to talk about is this chair. But let's table the chair for a moment. Right.
Yeah.
So.
How's it going, guys? I'm really making it hard for you.
I think it feels like it's flowing beautifully.
It's going to be a great edit.
This is where the edit comes in.
Well, you probably know that I enjoy playing with form, if you know my books.
Yes.
I like to. So I'm just giving you a little taste of how tiring it is to actually be me.
Andy, I've got a question for you. Speaking of editing, because your books come across as, and then take this in the way it's meant, as quite
as
raw,
awful,
and
just
fresh,
awful.
And
please take it in the way that I intend.
Take
but they
it
come
in the
across
spirit
as really
intended.
They're very lousy. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I will. Thank you. As raw and unedited, that's hilarious.
No, but brilliant. Kind of like really. I think it gives them a life, doesn't it?
They've got
such a spark and a life to them that they feel like they've not been. Some books you can tell have been edited with an inch of the life, and this and it kind of flattens out the life.
It's a great starting point, a great talking point.
But are yours?
My books are. I edit my books.
Right.
I edit with brilliant editors.
Mm. Yeah.
It's not, but they are edited by me and by my editor to within 1/1000th of a thousandth of a thousandth of an inch of their lives. The trick is to make it seem fresh and effortless.
Yeah.
Which I. Hopefully pull off more than I don't. But I am absolutely, ridiculously, horrifically exacting.
That is quite interesting.
And yeah. I might at some point send you a little document showing you some of my notes for one of the books. We'll see. It won't be for public consumption, probably. But
yeah, yeah.
I've driven probably more than one editor or a copy editor to an early grave with my... I literally have notes and notes and notes even as it's going to press. If it's, you know, a week before, 3 days before. And I...
I must love that.
Well, yes and no. Mostly no. I'll rethink a comma three times, or I want a hyphen instead of a comma, or I've often asked in the Mr. Gum books to change the pagination, to cheat the pagination a bit, so a particular punchline will appear at the top of the next page instead of the end of the page we're on.
Right.
And it's to that... I haven't done this for a while. I haven't written a Mr. Gum book for a while, so I'm trying to... I can't even remember how exacting I am, but it's even worse than I'm explaining, than I'm describing. But yes, I will be... And then I'll see something that we can do with the illustrations, and I'll go, hey, could we actually reuse that illustration? There's an illustration on... In book four, where Mr. Gum is chasing the heroine Polly, where it's a chapter called Chasing Time, I said, let's reuse that illustration. Let's put it on the next page, but move Mr. Gum a bit closer to Polly, and then let's reuse it again on the next page and move them closer again. I'm editing the text for all sorts of things. I'm changing one word in a joke because I feel like it clashes with a word 75 pages later, no lie. I'm changing commas, I'm changing full stops, hyphens, I'm changing where the words fall on the page, and I'm saying, hey, we can get an extra game out of the illustration with
wow.
The and that.
So it's all pretty loose then. It just kind of comes out.
Loose is probably the word that I'm trying to... that's probably the take out from what I'm trying to say.
So this very strong sense that you're having a really fun time writing these books and it's just flowing out of you is all just total crap.
Well...
Is it actually painful for you?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you quite enjoy being that exacting?
The exacting bit is... It's not exactly painful, that exacting bit, because you're only being that exacting when you've got something to be exacting with. So that means you've basically done the book and you've done enough drafts that it's basically happening now, and you can go down to the wire on those things. There are still things that I wish I hadn't cut, or tiny, tiny things that no one else would ever notice in a million years that I wish I'd put in the books, or I hadn't, I missed one trick. Oh, I got 2007 tricks done into that book, but I missed one. It's like when you're on stage and you're trying to make people laugh, and any comedian will tell you this, but you always see the one person not laughing. It doesn't matter if you're bringing down the Albert Hall. There's one guy, J16, didn't crack a smile. And that's all you think about. So that's what I think about. I think, there was one more joke I didn't put in that book. That bit is actually like watchmaking to me. That's really enjoyable, although it drives me bonkers to be that exacting. It's the actual writing that I find really painful. It's lovely that you think it flows. When the actual writing and invention and story making is flowing, it can happen. It's a lovely feeling. I'm sure you must have experienced it at some points, and you really feel like you're in the flow, you're in the beat. It feels like everything is... You know, if you were playing sport, it would be like, oh, he's seeing the ball like a grapefruit, don't they say? And that's when you just sort of, you're holding the story lightly but tightly at the same. You're in control of it, but you feel like you can see it from all angles. You can see what move to make next. That's rare when you get into that flow. Mostly for me, the writing bit, that's the pain. Getting to the end of a first draft is the hardest.
And how long would that normally take you, or does it massively depend on just how you're feeling, whatever the book is that you're writing, or
piece of string question, isn't it? I'll tell you how it mostly worked for Mr. Gum, which is that firstly you're looking for an idea. The idea can take months. It can when it comes, you go, oh, it came in the second. No, it's months of rejecting other ideas. Let's say I've got an idea that I think will start off a Mr. Gum book, and I think I can see an ending in sight. I've got some idea of where it might end up, and I feel like there's enough to sustain a middle. So let's just say I've got an idea in 3 seconds flat, for the sake of argument. How long does it then take to write? Okay, if I'm lucky, that first draft, and these books are only about 11,000 words, not very much, but they've got to be the right words. That might take me, if I'm lucky, I'll get a first draft in 3 weeks, but more likely, I'll start that story, get a third of the way through and decide it hasn't got legs, or I'll get a third of the way through and decide that there's a better story, that this isn't.
Oh, wow. Go back to the beginning.
It's a difficult process to describe. I'm very inefficient. Okay, let me put it another way. Mr. Gum is about 11,000 words. For most of those books, I wrote at least 30,000 and probably as much as 50,000 for some of them. So how'd you like them? Apples.
That's a lot of apples.
That's a lot of apples. Too many apples. Yeah, and some of them aren't very good, and you have to get rid of those ones. I've written entire manuscripts of Mr. Gum, got to the end of the first draft, and then thought, hate it. I wrote the second book, Mr. Gum and the Biscuit Billionaire, second book. I have an entire book called Mr. Gum and the Biscuit Billionaire, which is a completely different story. Got to the end of it, hated it, and rewrote. I kept one thing. I kept the character, the biscuit billionaire, who is a gingerbread man with electric muscles called Alan Taylor, who's got a billion pounds.
I love the idea that you've rewritten the entire book, but there's just like I can't be asked changing the title.
I'll have to
keep him.
I like the character, but I got the wrong story for him.
Right.
I'll briefly summarise the two stories, and you can see if you think I picked the right one. So the one that was published, Mr. Gum and the Biscuit Billionaire, a gingerbread man with electric muscles called Alan Taylor comes to town, and he's got £1 billion in a biscuit tin, and he doesn't really understand about friendship. So he tries to impress everyone with his money rather than get to know them. So he throws a massive funfair to impress the town and win his favour. Mr. Gum and Billy William III, the villains, then steal his money at the funfair. Alan Taylor gets depressed and retires to bed. The heroines, Polly and Friday O'Leary, track down Mr. Gum and Billy, recover the money. There's a big fight, and Alan Taylor has learnt the power of friendship, and everything's fine, right? That's the published version. The first version was also called Mr. Gum and the Biscuit Billionaire. A gingerbread man with electric muscles called Alan Taylor with £1 billion and a biscuit tin came to town. He threw a funfair to impress everybody. In this story, he had a girlfriend called Chocolatey Claire, who was a cake. Alan Taylor and Chocolatey Claire went in the tunnel of love during the funfair. And when they emerged, Chocolatey Claire had been eaten. And Alan Taylor was then framed for murdering Chocolatey Claire by Mr. Gum and Billy, who threw a kangaroo court trial for him to convict him of murdering his girlfriend, when in fact it had been Mr. Gum who had been hiding in the Tunnel of Love and eaten Chocolatey Claire. And they sentenced Alan Taylor to death by foxecution, because I was thinking of the gingerbread man in the story who gets eaten by a fox in the river. So they had a fox who was going to eat Alan Taylor. So it was a story about murder, framing and capital punishment. Do you think I chose the right story? I think I did. But that's also reminded me there was another version of Mr. Gum and the Biscuit Billionaire where Alan Taylor was the headmaster of a school, which he kind of is. But in this one, he transformed, I think in a full moon or something, into a character called Oliver Knuckles, I think, who was like, he was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And basically, let me tell you, I've got a lot of drafts on my computer the world is never going to see. But that should give you some of the ideas, some idea about how hard it is for me to find a story. And by the way, the story where Alan Taylor was a headmaster and it focused on the school had the heroine, Polly, going to school. Mm-hmm. And my heroine is 9 years old. And you never hear about her parents. I think there's one reference to her parents to her mum in book one, but that's it. And you never hear about whether she goes to school or not. She actually seems to exist in her own kind of reality. She seems to live alone. You don't really hear. It's like Charlie Brown. You never see the adults, right? Snoopy. You never hear about school. Sending her to school seemed to be playing. It's like it's the opposite of jazz. You know, you're meant to. It's the notes you don't play, right?
Yeah.
I found that sending Polly to school and making her into more of a normal kid was playing the wrong notes. It was playing the notes that I should keep silent.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't the story I wanted to tell. So these are the things that I think about, these rules, these things that stop me from writing or stop me from writing certain stories. I hate children's books that are about municipal things.
Mm.
I was always very depressed as a child, full stop. I was always very depressed as a child by stories that involved anything to do with mechanical diggers or trains or engines or lorries. I instinctively thought I hate that world, it's so banal. So in Mr. Gum there's never any of that. There's never anything municipal, really, or if it's there, it's only there as a mundane joke to make the world crappy for a moment.
And that's the same with Roald Dahl, isn't it? He would just extract you out of this sort of out of the family home and out of schools and out of that kind of world.
Well, that's right. But I borrowed a lot from Roald Dahl, but mostly what I borrowed was the idyll of the type of English country town or village that a lot of his stories would take place in, which were probably more real for him and more realistic, I mean, at the time.
Yes.
But which now, I'm taking a photocopied version of that and using it as like a trope of kids' stories. It's like, we all know that there aren't really that many towns like that these days. And again, I keep chain stores and that sort of mentality out of my books. It's all old fashioned shops and stuff in my books, because I'm riffing off a trope that people like Roald Dahl set up as more of a reality in their time.
That's very interesting. I can't quite believe it's so painful for
you. Believe there's actually a thinking brain behind this shit, can you? A lot of people can't. You're not the first,
I think that's the beauty of it, though. Could you tell us the story of how Mr. Gum came about in the first place? Because I think that might give us a sort of an idea of...
Do you know this story? Because I'm going to tell you either way, but I talk about this a lot. Have you read this anywhere?
I have,
This is a kind of the opposite of what I was just talking about in some ways, although still related. So I wasn't doing much with my life, and I had a lot of ideas. They go through my head, you can probably tell. And I'm very bad at developing them. I was about 30, something like that, and I was in danger of becoming one of those people who you sometimes see at parties. What do you do? Well, I'm working at the NHS, but I really want to do something creative. And then you see them a year later, don't you? And then you go, what are you doing? You go, well, I'm still at the NHS. And I love the NHS, by the way. I really do. And this, I was working at the NHS. That's why I'm using it as an example. I was a temp. But I love the NHS. Don't get me wrong. But it wasn't my calling. But yet, you know, people would see me again. Like, what are you doing? Well, I'm still at the NHS, but I still want to do something creative. I wasn't doing anything. I was have all these ideas. Any idiot can have ideas, as someone more clever than me has said, but it's what you do with it that counts, right? I wasn't doing anything. I got so frustrated of never developing anything, never seeing if I could back myself. But I wasn't developing these things. I wasn't actually putting myself to the test. It was Christmas Eve, maybe 2000, and 2002 even. Christmas Eve 2002, I was house-sitting at a cousin's house. I was going to see a bunch of my cousins the next day for Christmas. They all had kids that were about 7, 8, 9 at that time. I really like kids of that age. I really like playing with their brains. I really like talking to them and just conversing with those that sort of age group. I have an affinity for them. And I thought, right, goddammit, I don't want to just be that, the funny uncle, the guy at the party. Mm. I'm going to see if I can finish a story from start to finish. I'm going to write a story and I'm going to read it to them on Christmas Day like we're in Victorian times, right? Mm. And I had at that time a floppy disk with me. That's how long ago this was, 2002. I had a floppy disk, 3.5 inch or whatever it was. And I stuck it into my cousin's computer house. I was house sitting and I opened it up and there were a few scraps of writing. They were like literally a line here, a paragraph there. I thought, right, I'll choose one of these things and I will run with it. There was probably about 60 words saying, oh, there was a horrible old man called Mr. Gum and a big dog got into his village. I thought, fine, roll with it. I started writing. It was 11 o'clock Christmas Eve, 2002. And I started writing. And I just wrote forward. It's the hardest thing to do. Mm. It's the hardest thing is to just write. Don't worry about how crap it is. Mm. Don't edit as you go along. Don't look back. Just keep adding. Add. If it was an improvisation, you'd call it yes and. Mm. Keep your idea, you know, yes your ideas and add to them. Yes your ideas and add to them. And that's what I did. As I wrote, all these other characters came into the story. I thought, oh, Mr. Gum seems pretty horrible. I had better give him a sidekick friend who's just as stupid or even more stupid to him. That will be funny. Who would be the friend of a man like that? Oh, a horrible butcher, Billy William III. About five chapters in, I realised that this definitely feels like a kid's story, but there are no kids in it. Okay, I better have a kid. Who shall it be? All right, up until now, everybody has basically been a grotesque old man. I better put some feminine energy into this thing. And great, I came up with a nine-year-old girl called Polly, who is my favourite character. But this was just an improvisation with myself. I've put those in place. What does that lead to? A horrible sidekick. What do two horrible old men need to counteract them? A really plucky young girl. So all these characters just strolled in. I wrote for 7 hours straight, eight hours straight. It was 6, 7 a.m. Christmas morning. The birds were chirping outside. I typed the end. Wow. All I wanted to do was just do this to see if I could finish something. I read it to my cousins on Christmas Day. They didn't listen to me that much because it was like formalising our relationship a bit. I'm going to read you a story now, kids. And also, they'd had too much chocolate. They were overexcited. It was Christmas. I read it to them. I thought, brilliant. I have proven myself. I felt like a bit of an idiot reading it and sort of getting a funny, you know, getting a half-interested reaction off my cousins. I took it home and I forgot about it for two years. 2 years later, I found it in a drawer. I thought, this is really good. Mm. I made a few very small changes to it. I thought it was very short, although it was very dense with meaning and funnies.
So you added some spaces.
I added some spaces, yeah, it's just to fool the agents. I added the subroutine of Jonathan Ripples, Martin Launderette, and a little girl called Peter, who functioned sort of as a Greek chorus throughout that book. And I thought it was probably just to pad it out a bit, but it seemed like a funny routine that could recur through the books, which it did. And then I sent it off to some agents, basically, and that's the story. So to cut a long story about a short story short, that's the only time in my life that I've ever been able to really... There's one night in my life where I accidentally gave myself a commission and a career, and it was just from writing without fear, writing forward and improvising with myself and not worrying about the quality till later. That's the story. It sounds like a fairy tale. You don't write your first book in one night and that book doesn't go on to be a series and a best-selling series and 35 countries or whatever it's in, but it
did. I was believing it. I believed it all, Andy, until you started saying it was Christmas Eve. Then you just stretched it too far. It just becomes unbelievable.
I know.
Was it snowing? Was it snowing as well outside? And were the children carol singing? And was it just a...
Sure, why not? And then I bought the biggest turkey in the lot.
Yeah.
But the thing about that story is that it's very rare to write with such flow.
Yeah, yeah.
But also that flow was born out of, in its own turn, years and years of frustration and annoyance at myself for not doing that stuff. So even then, did I write it in one night or did I write it in 20 years getting frustrated with myself, or 15 years ago, you know, a little of both.
You're like the human personification of this podcast.
I saw the title of it and I thought that's the podcast for me, guys.
Yeah.
One of the other ways that you managed to elongate the book was to you gave Polly a full
name.
Oh,
well, that's...
Can you remember her full name off by heart, by the way, just out of interest?
Well, I can, but I can't prove it to you that I'm not reading it off anything, but that wouldn't be any fun, would it? But Polly's full name is Jammy Grammy Lammy for Hopper Berlin Stereo EO EO Leb Siep Mnemonica Lestrepet De Grespin De Crespin De Spespin De Vespin De Whoop De Loop De Bronco Merry Christmas Lenoir. But most people call her Polly to save timing for convenience's sake. But that was in the first draft without a single change. And that was a microcosm of how I wrote that night, which was I introduced this girl into the book. She immediately seemed like she was going to be the straight man or the straight girl to all the idiotic adults around her. But I wanted to, looking back on it, I think I wanted to codify her. So although she's the straight one, she's the sensible one.
Yeah.
She's still the part of that cartoon world.
Yes, she's not normal.
Yeah.
There's still some element of.
So you don't want to make your heroes or heroines all good, and you don't want to make your villains all bad, which is pretty basic stuff. You want to have sympathetic villains and flawed heroes, or at least interesting heroes. So she's an interesting mix of virtue and morals, but also she's still properly a 9-year-old girl with a bit of tomboy in her. And she's also of that world. So although she's Polly, secretly in her DNA, she's Jammy Grammy Lammy. So she's of that world. Mm. And the other thing about her, which you probably know, is that she has really bizarre diction.
Yes.
Which is like, I always...
She pluralises a lot of things.
She pluralises a lot of things because she sort of says, I hate Mr. Gum. So a lot of parents reading to their kids do Polly as West Country because of the I hates that. She's not West Country in my head. They especially do it if they're from that part of the country, which is, you know, it's all fine, it's all cricket, their book to do with what they want. In my head, she's like a Cockney street urchin, right? Or that's her. But basically, she's kind of like a street urchin with the diction of a Mississippi blues man. And that's how I think of her. So she's just got really, really idiosyncratic. They've all got quite idiosyncratic ways of talking, but Polly takes the prize for that. So because she's the straightest character, she has to have other things built into her DNA for that, to be of that same world. So yeah, these are all things I think about. I can tell you so many interesting to me secrets of the things that tie those books up under the surface. I'll tell you one more because I find it interesting.
Yeah.
I mentioned Snoopy and Charlie Brown before, Peanuts. Yeah. I always loved in Peanuts how... and by the way, the title, You're a Bad Man, Mr. Gum, which is the first book. Oh, that first night, by the way, when I wrote the book in one night, as it were, the story for a while was just called The Story of Mr. Gum. But by the time I sent it off to agents 2 years later, I'd found a better title, which is You're a Bad Man, Mr. Gum, which is stolen completely for rhythm and intent from You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, which is one of the name of one of those Snoopy compendiums, little paperbacks back in the 70s. And it's just got such a lovely rhythm. You're a Bad Man, Mr. Gum. I'm sure Schultz is responsible for most of my financial success just for that rhythm. And but the other thing, the more subtle thing I took from Snoopy is that I always loved in Peanuts how the characters referred to each other differently depending on who was speaking to who, right? So Marcy, who dotes on Peppermint Patty, always calls Peppermint Patty Sir, even though Peppermint Patty is a girl. Marcy's got this thing she always calls Peppermint Patty Sir. Peppermint Patty refers to Snoopy as the funny looking kid with the big nose. Peppermint Patty calls Charlie Brown Chuck, but no one else does. And there's a few others, I think. But that basically what I'm saying is that the characters have different relationships and modes of address for each other. And I took that Mr. Gum, for example, there are rules in Mr. Gum which emerged as I went along. One is Mr. Gum and Billy must never basically know Polly's name. They must always refer to her as that horrible little girl. Everybody has to call Alan Taylor first and for and last name at all times, except for Mr. Gum, who only ever calls Alan Taylor. Polly refers to Jonathan Ripples as Jonathan Ripples Sir, just like Marcy calls Peppermint Patty Sir, but no one else does. And Friday calls Polly Little Miss. And the Spirit of the Rainbow always calls Polly Child, even though he's no older than she is. So what I'm trying to say is that I thought it was such a neat thing that it would put glue in under the story.
Yeah,
it would put dynamics in under the story that you won't be aware of them at that level. But it will make you feel like these are a group of characters who dynamically interrelate with each other and hold each other in different relation.
Yeah, that's a lovely way of doing it.
Well, I learned from the
best.
Did that
just happen organically then, as the characters grew out of it, or did you have to work that?
I think it was quite conscious that I'd always admired that in Schultz,
right.
And it became thicker as more characters in the books down the line came in, because Alan Taylor wasn't even in the first book. But just Friday calling Polly Little Miss in the first book, I could almost guarantee, if we went back to 2002, that what was going through my head was, it would be cool to cement the reality of these two by giving them different relationship games with each other because of Schultz.
Do you have a policy, just thinking about the nuts and bolts of putting your books together, do you have a policy on, like, gag ratio? Because there seems to be at least one really good gag on every page. Do you almost have that in your head, like, okay, I need something in here, or is it, does yeah, it just but, sort of happen?
Oh, God, you've got to have gags. It's a book about,
but almost to the extent where you're like, okay, I need one there, or is it just wherever it feels right?
You get them where it feels right. But the problem with gags is that they stop narrative, or take it sideways. Narrative wants to go forward, right? Gags take you to the left or the right, or they stop it altogether. If we were in an improvisational comedy scene and you started off with, what a lovely day it is for a picnic, isn't it? And I said, well, we're not even outside and we haven't got a picnic and I don't even know what a picnic is because we're on Mars, right? I've done a gag that builds and builds and builds on itself and actually trampled you into the ground. And it's kind of an interesting gag in some ways, but where's the scene gone? I've just popped the reality. So it's broken. Mm. It's stopped the narrative. It's what you'd call blocking in improvisation. And it's the opposite of yes and. So the trick is to make gags, but move the narrative forward at the same time. Writing a book is hard enough. Writing a story is hard enough at the best of times, and all books are hard to write. But with comedic writing, you have to advance forward whilst bringing your wingmen, or your wingwomen, or whatever you want to call them, your gags, along with you, all at the same time. It's sometimes great to go on a big digression if that's the joke, but you have to know when to end that digression and pull us back to it. The story as well, and then if you've done one big digression, and then 3 pages later there's another big digression, your narrative is going to start suffering. So the trick is always to advance plot, character, actual emotional stakes, and get those side cheerleaders, the gags, to come forward with you at the same time.
So you've had to leave some pretty good gags on the cutting room floor then over the years.
You've got no idea. Entire routines.
Right.
Entire routines, or some routines end up in the books but cut down because they overstayed their welcome.
Yeah.
Another rule of thumb for comedy is don't overstay your welcome.
Yeah.
If you look at the average length of a Hollywood drama, it's going to be more like 120 minutes as compared to the average length of a Hollywood comedy. It's going to be more like 90 minutes. Yeah. Comedy works better. And gets it, but comedy has a different framework and demands a different treatment, and shorter is best. Like, my books are short even for the age range that I'm writing for. They're not it's not a haiku, but they're so dense with gags that they're the length they are for a reason.
Mm.
You can go back and read them again and find more stuff in there, but like, again, this is analogous to all writing. You're always, whatever type of writing you're doing, funny or not, you're always trying to balance what your effect is and whether you're boring the reader or whether you're adding to this. So it's analogous. Comedy has its own rules, but they are also transferable to other skills and tools that you use during, you know, in all manner of writing.
Have you had this all your life, Andy, this want of playfulness and in your head? Like, you know, when you're at school and you're doing English, was it always
correct?
There?
Correct. Absolutely, 100%. I've got old text, workbooks from when I was 8 or 9, and there's stuff in there that, like, could almost just go straight into Mr. Gum.
Right.
It's the same thing. It's playing with fake endings or just talking to the reader or all sorts of things that I had in me really, really early on. Mucking around with the conventions of stories.
How did that fit in with academic life in terms of teachers? And
oh, if it's the teachers who liked me and liked that in me really encouraged it, and other teachers, it drove them absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, it was like if there was someone there who had the ear for that or recognised that that was a good thing, they were my champion.
Yeah. Mm.
There was a really great teacher of mine who I totally fancied when I was about 8 called Miss Yates. She looked a bit like an art teacher, right. If you know what I mean. Yeah. She had the cool haircut and dangly earrings, but she was an English teacher, but she loved my stuff. She actually taught me one of the most important lessons as a writer I've been taught in my life, which is she loved my stuff, but she would call me out if it was bullshit too. There was one thing I did that was just, we had a writing exercise to do, she gave us, we had to make this story with these characters she gave us. It was a really cool exercise. She gave us like 5 types out of sword and sorcery type stories, right? Mm. There was a hero with a sword and there was a wizard. They all had names and stuff. There was a dwarf called Little John. There was a magician. And she said, right, here are your characters. They're all trapped in a dungeon, right?
Mm-hmm.
What happens? How do they get out? Write how they get out. And they've got to get out get them out onto the edge of a forest or something, right? Mm. The next day she said, right, all your characters are in the forest now. Now they've got to cross the forest. What perils do they face? And they've got to get to the river. She got us basically writing a sword and sorcery adventure, chapter by chapter, day by day.
Wow.
We didn't, with these characters she'd given us, and we could do anything. So I started playing this game where everyone hated Little John in my band of brothers, right? And whatever was happening, it would be Little John who got attacked. And he would just get like, and I started drawing in the story Little John's medical report card every day. And he was like, by about day 3, he had like about 9 daggers stuck in him. He had stinging nettle rashes. He had like one of his legs was half chopped off or whatever. Right? He had plague. I can't remember what. Right. About day 4, Miss Yates says to me, "This is really." She writes on my book, "This is really, really funny. This is classic you." But I don't see 1 ounce of emotion in this.
Mm.
Where's the emotion? Where's the story? That's the lesson.
Yeah, it's a good lesson.
But I'll tell you what happened though. So the next day, wanting to do anything to please Miss Yates, I had like, oh, that day we all decided to gather around Little John and, oh, Little John, we love you so much. We're so sorry you've gone through all these vicissitudes, right? Right, and I started over-egging it the other way. It was like, oh, Little John, we never told you how much we really emotionally think about you, right? And then the wizard said, I found these herbs of healing, right? I've got these herbs of healing. And I was really pouring the syrup on now to answer this criticism, yeah? And they restored Little John back to full health, and I showed his medical card. And then he said, Little John, almost as good as new, right? Last day, last day of the adventure, the heroes had gone through all these things and they're going to win the day, right? They went, right? So I ended my story. And then they've vanquished the last beast, defeated the last foe or whatever. And then they were all rewarded with gold and cups and silver and blah, and new medals and shields and sort, right? Blah, 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 blah. And then the very last line of my story was, and then Little John died of exhaustion in the end. So, like, I did, but so even then, I had to be a smart ass about it and win the game. But actually, the important lesson as a writer, you've got to write emotion, even if you're doing funny.
It's
stuff.
Got to matter, hasn't it? Ultimately, you've got to care.
Otherwise, you've lost everyone. It's stakes. Emotional stakes and characters are as important in a humorous story as they are in any other story, or it is just. And then he fell in some trifle, and then a cat exploded out of his eye, and then a man came up selling radiators, and he had 1,000 legs. And it's like, yeah, okay, great. Who cares? So, and then another way, later on, my all-time favourite TV programme, or just absolute inspiration, is the first 8 seasons or so of The Simpsons, right?
Mm.
And I was a really big Simpsons nerd.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
Yeah, of course. There's a bit of Springfield in Lamonic Bibber, the town in the Mr. Gum books, in that whatever geographical features need to serve the story suddenly seem to appear in Lamonic Bibber. And that's borrowed from Springfield.
There's a lot of playing with form as well, isn't there, in the Simpsons?
Of course, of course. It was totally I used to watch it so much. I didn't have Sky, but a friend did when it first came out. It was just on Sky. He used to video. God, this is all so old. Really dating me. Wrote it on a floppy disk. He used to use VHS tapes and wax cylinders. And he used to tape me on long play. Do you remember long play? You could make a 4-hour tape into an 8-hour tape. So I think they were shown like twice a day on Sky or something. He'd get me like 15, 20 episodes, put them on a long play VHS, and I would just binge them to the extent that I remember falling asleep one night and hallucinating tiny Simpsons characters running around my pillow as I fell asleep. Like, I could see them. I would see them. But then when they were all available on DVDs, I started collecting the DVDs, and I watched every one with the commentary on as well.
Wow.
I would watch the episodes with the commentary and hear the creators talking about them. And same story. The composer, not Danny Elfman, who did the theme, but Alf Clausen was the guy who scored the episodes. He said he never played to the comedy or the content of the scene. Mm. He would try and find the score that underscored the emotional truth of the scene. So that, again, is another long way of saying always keep the whatever I'm doing on the surface of Mr. Gum, there has to be emotional core going on underneath. And Miss Yates taught me that, and The Simpsons taught me that.
Well done, Miss Yates.
Absolutely.
There's a bit in a Guardian article from a few years ago where you're quoted as saying, a kid asked me in a letter if there was a message in the Mr. Gum stories, and I wrote back that the message is that life is pretty stupid quite a lot of the time, but we may as well try to be nice to each other.
Which
I thought that was a great way of actually summing up the feel of the books.
Well,
it does. It's just got that core underneath
another
everything.
Another thing I love about The Simpsons, which makes it my number one, is the heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Big on heart and big on warmth.
Yeah,
and so that's important to me.
Definitely that parallel theme, isn't it? Because The Simpsons is very much about being big on heart and the warmth, like you say, despite the people involved.
Yeah, yeah.
Despite those rough characters.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Matt Groening says, look, all these terrible things happen. Bart gets bullied at school. Homer strangles Bart. They've got a dysfunctional family. But at the end, the episode, they're all sitting there, you know.
Yeah.
Everything's turned out well. It's hard. It's hard. The Simpsons at its best did triple duty on everything. Every moment, advance, plot, character, and gags, all at once, all going forward, and warmth. And I'm not really a Family Guy fan because it's anti-heart. And it's stridently and purposefully anti-heart.
Yeah, Family Guy's interesting in that, isn't it?
It is interesting, but they clearly started out with that intention. Even so, even though they try to be bleak and, you know, try to be to pop every shibboleth and taboo, as the series went on, the only way to sustain those characters was to actually admit some emotional heart into it. I still don't like it. I'm fascinated by it, and it more often than not makes me go, huh, that will be funny if I cared, or that will be fun, or I can see why that's funny.
I was just going to say before, Family Guy for me, I quite like it, but it's you know what you were saying before about the narrative's got to be driving everything and then things. Family Guy is like gag-driven narrative.
Well, yeah.
Where the gags kind of drag it into places that it wasn't going to go, but it needs to because that's funny, we need to keep that. So then it just gets a bit topsy-turvy.
Yeah, and like I say, I think over time, you would look at Family Guy and see where they started going. The characters have to relate to each other more, you know, whether it was an actual discussion or it just tended that way. If you don't put in some foundations underneath, you may as well be reading Christmas cracker jokes. Good ones. But
brings up quite a, sorry if this is too deep, a deeper question, but what is your favourite Christmas cracker joke, Andy?
Oh,
because I used to love annoying everyone in the family, in any family that I was spending time with, by guessing the punchline to Christmas cracker jokes.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a little...
Oh, we do that routinely. Mm. I like the ones that are inept, and a lot of them are.
You can't guess them though, can you? Yeah, those I don't like.
No,
those.
No. Some of them. Well, yes. There's many ways to be inept. My particular favourite type of inept Christmas cracker joke is the one that reuses a word in the feed line and the punchline.
Oh, where, yeah, no.
Where,
so
like,
you've discounted
like,
that. You've discounted that as your guess. Because it wouldn't be, and then then they say,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
know,
yeah.
Well,
I mean,
right?
But sometimes you can still guess them, even so. But it's such a rule. Like, I mean, there's a joke about mince spies, as in mince spies sounds like spies, doesn't it? And the joke, what's the feed line? It's something like, oh, what are the most, I don't know, secretive Christmas cakes? It should be right, mince spies.
Yeah,
or
yeah. What's James Bond's favorite Christmas treat?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. What's James Bond's favorite Christmas treat? mince pies. And a way, it's a rubbish joke, but a way to make that instantly more rubbish, and Christmas crackers routinely do this, is what is James Bond's favourite Christmas pies? Mince pies.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, oh, you don't really know how to.
But then you get the worst ones where you go, what's James Bond's favourite Christmas treat? And you go, mince pies. And they go, no, it's from Trifle with Love. I think there's something. Do you know, it's completely random. It's not a punch.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to do rubbish jokes. My favourite joke in The Simpsons ever, I've got two actually, but I think the one that's germane to what we're talking about now is Krusty the Clown and Bette Midler are hanging out. Krusty's doing a comeback special. He's got all these celebrities on, right? And so he's invited all these celebrities to help him get his career back on track. Bette Midler's one of the guest stars. They're hanging out in the dressing rooms, and Bette's going, "Oh, it's so good to see you again, Krusty." And yeah, remember that racehorse we bought together? That was a disaster. And she goes, "Yeah, Crudler. That was a disaster." So like they've called this racehorse Crudler after Krusty and Midler, right? Great in itself, because Crudler is such an ugly,
just a crap name
formation. Yeah. But it's even better when you realise what they missed calling it, which was the other half of Midler and the other half of Krusty, which results in a racehorse called Misty, which is beautiful.
That is good.
And they've called it Crudler. And it's so subtle, because it's funny even if you don't get the bonus joke. And the bonus joke makes it one of my top two jokes in The Simpsons ever.
I think maybe just as a final little flourish then, I should ask you, what do snowmen eat for lunch?
Oh, Jesus. What do snowmen eat for lunch or Christmas lunch? Just for lunch?
Just for generic everyday lunch.
Just for...
the time is on, Andy. Jesus. I'm afraid I'm going to have to rush you for an answer.
Hold on a second. I want to get...
It's a bad one.
Fish and precipitation. I don't know. What is it? Yeah, it sounds bad. What is it?
Icebergers.
Icebergers?
I mean, that's not even... Oh. That's one of those ones, isn't it?
Hold on.
So it's not an iceberg. Iceberg doesn't really relate to snowmen.
Breakfast.
Well, iceberg doesn't relate to snowmen, and it doesn't sound like a type of food. Like, it doesn't sound like hamburgers.
Sound like burgers, does it? Yeah, no, it's terrible.
That's horrific. No. Is that a real Christmas cracker joke?
Yeah. This is on the list of 50 worst Christmas cracker jokes.
It should be. I don't know where you buy your Christmas crackers, but I want in.
I want more of them.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, dear.
Absolutely. What?
I feel ill.
What do you call Father Christmas on the beach? John, this is your turn. What do you call Father Christmas on the beach?
I know this one.
Father Christmas on the beach.
Come on, think about it.
Santa Claus? No.
I think it's Sandy Claus.
I'm afraid I can't give you that, John. We can only accept the correct answer, which is Sandy Claus. The bonus point goes over to Andy, I'm afraid.
Oh. I feel ill again.
Yeah.
Horrible. Just solid, I think is the word.
And for your jackpot final question, Andy, you've made it through to the final there by stealing those points off John. The final question is, what says O-O-O?
What says O-O-O?
Yep. I mean, it's badly written. It should say who says, but I don't know if they're trying to put...
How are you spelling the O?
O-H-O-H-O-H.
Okay. Well, it's like... It's some sort of Australian Father Christmas or backwards
can't
Father
say that.
Christmas.
That's quite racist saying Australia now, Andy. You can't say that. But it is indeed.
Yeah, it's quite racist, which is fine. But compared to how racist everyone is these days.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. Actually,
what's the answer?
Santa walking backwards.
Jesus.
Which just that's such a beautiful one, because that really doesn't work. Because it should be who says, not what says.
Yeah.
It's not Santa walking backwards, really, is it? Because
it could be Santa walking backwards, but the truth is that when you walk backwards, you don't automatically reverse your speech. It's not a given by any means.
Not,
in fact, I literally don't think I've ever been with somebody who started walking backwards and talking backwards. I have been with people who started walking backwards for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think the punchline for that one should actually be at NAS, shouldn't it?
Yeah,
which would work.
Yeah, that's just a really weird and sinister joke now, but it should be Atnas, yeah. I don't know why it's sinister. It just feels like... It feels arcane. just like this word. It should be in capitals as well. Atnas! And then just like...
Sounds like the kind of Russian spy agency that they would think of in a 1960s spy drama, isn't it? Man from Uncle kind of thing.
That's exactly what it sounds like. Yeah. At NASA.
Except he lets himself into everybody's house. That's quite creepy, isn't it?
At NASA agents do that, kids, when they're trying to play with your brain and brainwash you. God, that got weird.
Didn't it?
I thought it was weird when I was talking about my refurbishing my chair at the start, but Atnask is very
I was going to ask Andy what he's up to next. What's next? What are you into at the moment, Andy?
I am very slowly recording a comedy podcast for adults with a friend of mine in America who's a TV writer called Andy Bobrow, and we are working on a high-concept comedy podcast talking about painstakingness again. Yeah. We improvised it's all on the one subject. We improvised these episodes with a few beats that we might hit. We recorded the improvisations. I then transcribed the entire improvisations with every that I could put down, which resulted in about 950 pages of script. I then cut down each episode to get about 450 pages over 12 episodes, which is about 35 pages an episode. Then me and Andy rewrote those pages together with all the ums and ahs in and making it, again, as realistic as possible. We then performed the new scripts and recorded those, so it sounds like a conversation. And that is probably a really, really good... if that answers your question, it sounds like a real conversation. It sounds like we're just throwing it off the top of our heads, and it took tens and dozens of hours even to get to the point of being able to be performed as if it's a real conversation. And that's before you get to editing and multiple takes. So we're very slowly working on that, and it's going to be called The Tumbler's Willy podcast.
Okay. Any reason why?
Yeah, but I'm not going to say right now.
Oh, okay, can't say now.
No, but it's not as bad as it sounds.
It sounds excellent.
It does.
Where does the stimulus come from, the initial story?
Oh, just mucking around with my pal Andy, as I say. He's a TV writer in America. He's out in LA, and we were on Zoom when lockdown started, and we just started improvising this bit to amuse his son. Mm. And after this improvisation had gone on for about 35 minutes, I said, I think we should try and make this into a podcast. And that was my mistake. And Andy's mistake was saying, yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
So have you parked the nincompoops? Ask the nincompoops, or is that...
Oh, actually, me and my friend Carrie Quinlan, who's a brilliant actor or actress or whatever we say these days, and comedian... not going to say comedian, that's awful. She's a great actor and comedian, Carrie Quinlan, good friend of mine, showbiz. And we have this podcast called Ask the Nincompoops, where we have kids ask us whatever questions occurs to them, and we just lie to them in the most entertaining way we know how. And we're actually talking about doing another series soon.
Oh, great.
Because we used to get kids into the studio with us, and... have them it's going to be harder at the moment, so we thought probably we're going to look at doing somewhere we get asked for questions online,
right,
and just have us doing them, so we won't have the kids there, but it will be slightly different. But I think we're really itching to do some more, because they're really
although
fun.
The giggling kids in the background is pretty great.
It is, isn't it? We did a Christmas episode where we just asked for questions, and we had our friend Mark, who works at the podcast place that we work with. He was our question master who collated, and we had him play. We had a bit going where we were like, "You're going to be called, what was he called, Doodles or something? The Christmas elf, not Doodles. Oh, Jingles. Yeah, right." And his shtick was like, "I'm a grown man. I've got two children. I'm not Jingles." And we were going like, "There are kids listening. There are kids. You're Jingles. I'm a grown man. I'm 6 foot one. You're Jingles, the Christmas elf." And so, even if there aren't kids in the studio, we can find other games.
True. I do love though how you give the kids so much verbal abuse.
Oh yeah, that is always fun.
It is, and just you can really insult small children to their faces without any consequences. And I particularly enjoy
that. If you
know how
to do it, I wouldn't recommend. Trust me, me and Carrie are professionals.
Don't try this at home. Yeah.
No. It's a fine art of insulting children and making them enjoy that. And I wouldn't recommend it to just anyone.
It is a particularly good bit of the show.
No, you're right. Yeah, now you put me off. Great. There you go. Do you know what? We won't do it then.
Sorry, but it's true.
No, sorry, for anyone, any kids listening, no more fun, because the failing writers have told me not to. Sorry, guys.
How we roll.
Sorry, kids.
Oh, no, I was just going to say my teenage kids, who, strictly speaking, are way too old for it, we listen to it in the car. A lot.
Oh, that's nice. Well, then we'll try and make some more
Yeah, and, please do. Please do.
However they come out, it will be fun to get back on that horse again.
Andy, thank you so much for
coming. Yeah, I really appreciate
it. Thank you for having
me.
I love talking this stuff. So, yeah.
It was really interesting.
Yeah,
really
genuinely interesting. Well, that's some very good points.
I love when people say it was, I genuinely liked the present you got me for my birthday. Okay. I really.
No, no, a lot of it was really interesting. Andy.
Yeah. Really, so quite a lot of it was useful.
Yeah. I got so many more questions, but we need to let you go, don't we?
Because up to you guys. I've got nothing to do. This is my life.
I really wanted to ask you about the musical version of Mr. Gum and the Dancing Bear.
This interview is over.
That says everything I need to know. Thank you very much, Andy.
Thanks so much, guys.
This year, the Dave's Edinburgh Comedy Award has aptly been won by a man called Dave. According to judges, Dave Baird, 42, from Bristol, stood out because his set was so unfunny, it was actually very funny.
Yeah, I mean, I'd been doing bits of comedy for years, like on and off, like, you know, a bit of stand-up, sketches, sitcoms. Then we were having Christmas dinner, and I read out one of the jokes in the crackers, and... I mean, I'd never had such a great reaction, you know, falling about the place. So, and it all just sort of snowballed from there, really. See, that's a little Christmas snowball. Never mind.
From sitting around the house thinking about writing to performing stand-up comedy in front of packed-out stadium venues, Dave's road to success has been almost completely implausible.
Right, hang on, just let me, Oh, right, okay. What carol is heard in the desert? O camel, ye faithful. Yeah. I mean, it's been unbelievable, you know, the response. I just pop a cracker and read out the joke. I mean, it's pretty easy, to be honest. I did try and do one of my own jokes once, but it didn't go down very well. So I'm sticking with this for now. Okay, let's try another one. What do you get if you cross Santa with a detective? Santa Clues? Yeah. Bring it on. Yeah, keep it coming. Yeah, applaud. Mm-hmm. Laugh. Yes,
Davey.
After.
Wake up.
Yes, la.
Dave. What? Wake up, Dave.
Hey?
Oh, Dave, you're nodding off, mate. Oh, John was banging on about Shakespeare or something, and you just went. You just zonked out like a light.
Oh, balls.
Hey, oh. But you're sad you missed that now, aren't you, Birdie?
Do you know what?
Silly sausage.
I am genuinely sorry I missed that. That sounded like
silly,
a lot of
silly
fun.
Silly boy. I got chills listening to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure chills is the right word.
Good chills. The good chills.
Oh, good. Yeah, chills. Okay. Yeah. But no, it was good.
That's like a must listen, I think.
I think.
You know what I mean?
Well, it was, yeah.
All writers should hear that.
Yeah. So you're saying that, though, it's just happened. So maybe say it's a must listen before... we play it, not just like just after.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
Yeah, just got a handful of people agreeing with you going, yeah, it's a shame more people wouldn't listen to that, John.
Well, maybe they'll go and tell other people.
I hope so. That's what isn't it?
To listen. Yeah. That would be nice.
But there were a lot of things to take out of that in terms of sort of, you know, writing method and that usual thing, wasn't it, about just get some stuff down. Don't worry too much about it. Just get some things in there. But what was a really good one was when he was talking about... like using specific names between characters, having the characters. I think somebody else, another guest we interviewed, said something like that. Was it Chris Paling said something about he decided to always refer to a character by their full name, it gave him a better like understanding of who they were. I think that was him. But anyway, I've tried that and make sure that I always refer to characters in the same way. Some of them, it's first name, some second name, some like full title. And it really helps to sort of cement who that person is in your own mind as you write.
Yeah, definitely. And do you know what I've done? I've actually stuck a post-it on my shelf in the study that says, Andy Stanton says, just write forward. So that's my little mantra.
It says, Andy Stanton, court case.
I think it's a good lesson for life as well, isn't it?
Just to blunder on regardless.
Yeah, definitely. Don't worry too much about whether you're doing the right thing. Just get on with it. Just you know, live in the moment. Yeah. Get on with living your life.
I wonder if the like we've spoken to quite a few successful people, but do you think with Andy, do you think there are any downsides to being so successful in the world of children's books? Do you know what I mean?
What, in terms of if you want to do something else?
Well, yeah, it looks very enviable, doesn't it, his career? But I was wondering how pigeonholed you get. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if it's actually harder in some ways to, like, swerve and do something else.
Yes, again, John, that would have been a good question to ask Andy.
you're right.
During the actual interview. I suppose so, isn't it?
Or does it just open doors, whatever you do? Do you know what I mean? Because you're famous for something. I don't know.
Mate, that really is something you'd have to ask somebody who's ever had any sort of success.
Remind me next time we interview somebody who's successful. I mean, you seem quite happy in it, to be fair.
But what have we got coming up in the future?
Well, next week is a bit of an interesting one. We've got, speaking of swerves, we've got a bit of a swerve, haven't we? We're interviewing, I guess you could describe him as an accidental author.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would that be fair?
Interesting. Do you know what? I will definitely be there for that one. Nothing. Wild horses will not keep me away from the next interview.
Good man. Unfortunately, I don't think you've read through the Failing Writers podcast rule book.
Not the amended.
If you intentionally miss an interview for reasons that can't be corroborated by the other two hosts, then you are on a one interview ban.
Has it got to be behind closed doors?
I'm afraid so, yes. You will be.
Bloody hell. Well,
you do the crime, you don't do the interview time.
Fine.
It clearly states
fine. You do it then.
You go to your bedroom, Dave.
I will.
And have a think about what you've done.
Yeah.
And I said think. Just think, okay?
Your time.
What are you doing in there?
Yep.
Thinking.
All right. But who's the interview with?
It's with.
Don't tell him, John.
Okay, don't tell him. He'd been a bad boy.
Don't deserve to know. Fine. Don't tell him.
It's Simon Griffin. Simon Griffin, who has written...
a book with a very rude title.
Can we say it? I'm allowed to say it. Can
we say it? Swear words.
You could beep it, couldn't you, Tom?
Beep it out.
It's called fucking apostrophes.
Yeah, I didn't beep
it. You didn't beep it, Tom.
Wrong word.
Beep it. For f***'s sake.
Sorry, do it. All right, do it again. I'll beep it.
The is called Fucking Apostrophes.
Oh, you don't need to swear again, John.
You little tinker. And he's also written a book called Fucking Good Manners. Tom.
Not doing it. Okay. Call me Little Tinker again, though, if you like. I quite like that.
You did like that, didn't you?
Yeah, I like it.
You let the payments lapse on the beep machine again,
Tom.
You've got to keep it up.
Put another 50p in.
Yeah, the stupid motherfucking cutting bastard beep machine. Oh, it seems to work, actually. I think maybe you just weren't vehement enough with your swearing, John. Try it again, but like really maybe. Give it some.
Okay. His second book is called Fucking Good Manners.
There you go, you see.
It worked that time. Yeah.
Just needs to be, it's about oomph, isn't it?
Good. Yeah, you just got to give it a bit.
Yeah.
But really interesting how he basically accidentally wrote a book.
It's an excellent book. It's a flipping bestseller.
It is, isn't it?
And it's
brilliant
just in
idea.
Time
if you're
for
looking
Christmas
for a
well,
Christmas present for an awkward to buy for person that doesn't mind sweary titles in a book, it's a good idea for that, isn't it?
It is, and it also it will also teach you how to use apostrophes properly, and you know we all could do better there, couldn't we?
I'm sure we could, but until then, it's probably time to say goodbye.
You're just trying to give Tom a bit of extra work there.
Yeah, I wanted to get.
He's a bit of a though, isn't he? Before we go, though, I just wanted to say we've had an entry for our new feature that doesn't have a name yet. How exciting is that? So we'll play that out next week as well.
Cool. I can't wait.
Very excited about that.
maybe this week we could call it Look at My F***ing Bastard Book.
Read this, you shit. Great. Brilliant. Well, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, but more the merrier. If you want to do a 30-second pitch for your book that's on sale, wherever it is, just do it. Email it to us or tweet us or whatever. Get it to Carrier Pigeon. We don't care how it comes.
Yeah. No.
As long as it's a voice memo of you talking about your book for 30 seconds exactly.
Probably not on cassette, though. Has anyone got a cassette player anymore?
Oh, yeah, no, I could do cassette. Actually.
Of course you can. Yeah.
Of course you can.
Does.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, until then. Let's go home. Should we all go home and have a cup of tea?
Lovely. Carry on writing, chaps.
On to the last week of NaNoWriMoRiMo, where I only need to write about 50,000 words.
Yay!
Hey, guys, you got this.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Do you know what? I think I saw it, actually.
Keep that recording in my ears on a loop, and that'll help me to get through.
Yeah. I think everything that you can take out of that, though, I just hope that Andy can sort his chair out.
I know, it's so true.
Yeah.
So true. It sounds like such a great chair.
It does,
as well.
Doesn't it? Like real.
Yeah, it'd be such a shame if you just had to throw it away.
Yeah. Oh, don't say that, John.
It would be a shame.
No, no. I can't believe I'm saying it.
Hello?
Hello?
Where's everybody gone?